Thank you, Noel. It's a pleasure to be here, and I've had a wonderful time at St. Catharines. They've done an awful lot of preparatory work for my visit and have related a number of different subjects to space. They've done projects where they did artwork about space. The younger children have looked at the solar system and looked at rockets. We looked at the biology of space flight, of course, the lectures in geography. So there have been lots of things that have been related to the space program, and that's been wonderful to see a whole school sort of have a section where they related a number of things they were studying to the space program. I hope you'll enjoy some of the pictures that I'm going to show you from space. Besides the main mission of every flight, we spend an awful lot of time with our noses pressed to the windows so that we can look out and see what the Earth looks like, because it is a very unique view. It's a view that very few people get to have, and it's something that we get a lot of training on. Most of us took geography in school, but we learned it from maps like this, and we now know that when you really go there, it looks a lot different. The countries aren't in different colors, and there's no line in between. And so we have to learn to recognize countries around the world by certain features. And there are many very distinctive features around the Earth that if you wake up in the night and look out the window, you can say, aha, that's where I am. Other times, they look very much alike. You can see a mountain range and be not sure whether you're over the Alps or the Andes. And so we spend a good bit of time learning about what the Earth looks like. We look at the pictures that our fellow astronauts have brought back, and we get lots of lectures on geography, also on geology, so that we can recognize what we're looking at, not only where it is, but what it is. Also on oceanography and meteorology, because believe it or not, there's a great deal to see in the ocean. When you look into the sun glint patterns, you can see that there's lots of texture in the ocean. There's a lot of life in the ocean. There are a lot of strange features in the ocean, and so we get to see that. Also meteorology, learning to recognize weather patterns, sometimes reporting weather patterns down to Earth as we pass by, because we're looking real time and the weather satellite may not come over for several hours. There's a big difference between what you can see in satellites and what you can see with the human eye. There's even a difference between what you can see with the human eye and what you can pick up with a camera. So a lot of times the reports we bring back, we have a picture and we'll say, this is what the picture looked like, but we could see detail in this area and have to describe it. So we spend a lot of time in preparation for this. It's a very enjoyable thing to do. It's part of the sightseeing that we do. Unfortunately, we don't have an awful lot of time to do it, but with the number of flights, and we've had something like 64 shuttle flights so far, plus all of the Apollo missions, the Gemini missions, the Mercury missions that have brought back pictures. So if you look back in the archives, most places have had their pictures made at one point in time. So if we could, I've picked out some of the pretty ones. I can't claim to have covered the entire world and every part of it. Can't do that in a 30 or 40 minute lecture, but hopefully we'll get to see some of the sights. Just to set the stage for you, here we are on the launch pad, getting ready to go into space. We fly the space shuttle itself into low Earth orbit. We're about 200 to 400 miles above the surface of the Earth. This is what it looks like as you head off uphill. If we launch directly east out of Cape Canaveral, our orbits look something like this. And we cover the area between 28 degrees north and 28 degrees south. If we have a reason to launch up the east coast, we can go as high as 56 degrees north and south and get to see much more of the Earth. The Russians launch out of a launch site up at about 52 degrees, so most of their flights cover a wider area than our standard shuttle mission. But when we begin to do cooperative missions, we'll probably put our space station at about 52 degrees so that the Russians can reach it from their launch sites. The United States is somewhere around 40 or 45 degrees north, so My last two flights have gone up to 39 degrees north and south, so we've gotten to see a fair section of the Earth. This is what the shuttle looks like when it's on orbit. The way we can take pictures, we have a number of windows, the windows that the pilots, of course, look out to do the landings and to fly the shuttle. We have two overhead windows that were designed, of course, for doing rendezvous with other spacecraft, so you can look out and see as you drive up close. They're also very good for looking at the Earth if you're turned over upside down. There are also two windows in here that look out on the cargo bay. They're also very good for looking when you're in this kind of attitude. You can see that you'd be looking down like this. There are some flights, however, that require, for instance, if they have an instrument in here, like a telescope, that the payload bay be pointed at the stars or at the sun. And on those missions, you don't get very good pictures of the Earth. So we really like it when we can point this whole cargo bay down towards the Earth, because that gives us the maximum amount of time to get pictures. This picture, by the way, was taken on my husband's first flight on Challenger. It was taken by one of the astronauts who had a backpack on, sort of like Buck Rogers, and flew off a distance. My husband's face is probably right there. And I asked the girls this morning if they could find the second crew member who was doing the spacewalk. And you can really only find him if you know that they asked him to move where he couldn't be seen so he could get they could get a good picture. He's right here underneath the mechanical arm hiding, but they did have two people out on the spacewalk at this point in time. Very nice picture of the shuttle, too. How do we get pictures? Again, this is the flight deck. You're looking, you'd be standing back behind the commander's seat, where all of the instrument panel is, and you've turned around and again looking out these overhead windows at the Earth. These are the windows that look out at the cargo bay, but you can see that they also give you a nice picture of the Earth. We have a number of the different cameras that we would use. This is, I believe, a Nikon camera with a huge lens on it. It's a 35 millimeter camera. We have the Hasselblad cameras that have a 75 millimeter format. It's the standard format for Earth observation because it is a larger format. We sometimes put two Hasselblads next to each other in a dual mount so we can get stereoscopic views or do a comparison of film. We might use regular visible light film and an infrared film to compare the two kinds of cameras, two kinds of films and pictures. We also have what's called a large format camera. And I believe, I'm not sure what its image size is, but it's much bigger than the Hasselblad. So depending on how much room we have on board and what our particular interests are or what the particular mission is, we can use a number of different kinds of cameras to get these pictures. Well, this is where we start from. You may have heard, especially if you're a woman, that anatomy is destiny. Sometimes geography is destiny. This is Cape Canaveral. This is the Florida Peninsula. And Cape Canaveral is the southernmost of the many capes that jut out into the Atlantic Ocean. And it's formed, of course, by all of the mud and the sand that washes down from the Appalachian Mountains and out into the ocean. And it's a very good launch site because you can launch from here out over the Atlantic and not worry about any pieces or parts falling off on populated areas. It's also more efficient to launch closer to the equator. It takes less fuel to launch directly east and stay over the equator. If you launch northward, you get to see more of the Earth, but it takes more fuel to do that, and you can carry less of a payload. So this was the closest point to the equator that was in a nice area that made the launch over unpopulated areas, and that's why it was chosen. Lake Okeechobee, the Florida Keys, some of the cities that are up the west coast of Florida and up into the Carolinas. By the way, you're geography teachers, and if you catch me saying something wrong, if I've named some place that you look at it and say, no, that's not that place, tell me so I don't confuse you and I don't confuse the kids and I can learn something. As you head east out over the Atlantic, this is Florida and the Florida Keys, you begin to see some areas that look like this, and they're scattered out over this part of the Atlantic, and these are the Bahama banks. They're part of the crust of the earth that formed when Florida formed. Other parts sank down. The areas that are of shallow water have reefs, but the reefs are made of completely different material than the reefs of the Great Barrier Reef. What happens here is there's a lot of calcium in the water from the seashells, and they combine with carbon dioxide in the air and form a material that sinks down and forms sediment along here. So it's a non-living reef. It's formed from calcium carbonate, and I think it's called aragonite. But it's a very different kind of reef. But these areas are tens of meters deep, and this area out here are thousands of meters deep. So they're very distinctive, and as you pass over them, they can be very beautiful, and you can understand why this would be a nice place to visit on a vacation. Nice beaches also. As we travel on across the Atlantic Ocean, you may recognize the Strait of Gibraltar. This is Spain, and this is Africa. That's the rock. And it's very interesting because, of course, this is the Atlantic and this is the Mediterranean. There's a cliff under the water here that disturbs the water as it comes in, and I think you can see creates wave patterns. These waves are not terribly visible from the surface. They're really more obvious underneath, but they do disturb the surface, and if you look at it in this perspective, you can see how they're coming in. We also can begin to see some of the texture in the sun glint. This area looks like there's not much going on, but again, when you see the sun glint, you can see the waves, you can see some swirls beginning to form as eddies occur as the water comes in with the tide from the Atlantic. If we stop down just a little bit south, this is North Africa, this is the Nile. Isn't it a beautiful perspective? It's a kind of a leaf-like pattern for some reason out here, and as the Nile Delta forms on the coast, this is the Mediterranean, the Sinai Peninsula here, the Gulf of Suez, the Gulf of Aqaba, Suez Canal is up in here. A very interesting perspective taken with a wide-angle lens in order to get the very long-distance shot. And of course, this is the shuttle as it's upside down and we're looking out the back windows. You can frequently see haze from the dust storms that sweep across North Africa, and indeed on subsequent orbits we can follow the pattern of these dust storms and frequently see them as they come all the way across the Atlantic and get onto cars in Texas. So we find that lots of things that take place on one side of the world affect the weather on the other side. When we look out into the desert, we can often see things like this, and our people that train us on Earth observation say if ever you see anything completely round or completely straight, it's probably man-made because nature doesn't design things like that. These are center pivot irrigation patterns in the desert in Saudi Arabia. But if you look a little bit closer at the bigger picture here, why do they follow these patterns? And what they're doing is they're tapping water in tributaries in very ancient sea, very ancient riverbeds that are far beneath the surface. And they have to drill down to get them, but the water that's underneath the desert is following old tributaries and old river-type patterns. But pictures like this can help them. You know, if there's water here and there's water here, then maybe next your wells need to be along here because there's probably a connection between the two. You can see there are various stages. You know, they've got green ones that are working well. They've got ones that they've probably tapped most of the water out of. So a very interesting look at how man has affected his environment and how they're tapping water and making the desert grow. This is a nice picture of the boot of Italy and the island of Sicily, a bit closer up view, and what they were trying to capture in this is Mount Etna, and it's right there, and you can see that it's sending out a plume. Etna is a very active volcano, and being so close to Rome, it's about 2 hours travel time from Rome, it's a very well-studied volcano because it's close to some major universities, and people enjoy going down there and studying it. As we move further eastward, this is the spine of the Himalayas. This is the Tibetan Highland and India. And you get a real feel for the plate tectonics that are going on here. The plate of India pushing up, diving down underneath, and buckling up this section of the earth, raising this whole area up. It's very interesting to look at river patterns. Of course, in ancient times, the rivers probably flowed down this way and into the sea. But because of this intrusion, this pushing up of this whole area, what happens is many of the rivers come down and swing around all the way around the mountains there. The very large Brahmaputra River goes all the way around the corner and down into India before it empties further down into the sea. So a very high mountain range, a very high plateau, a very distinctive looking area. Something you ought to recognize, Shark Bay. We're now moving into Australia, and what I'd like to do is take you down from north, this is north, down the coast here and around the corner, and maybe look at the northern part of the island continent, the land down under, because it's very distinctive. Lots of red as seen from space. This part of the land is very distinctive, and as you come across the coastline, there's nothing much else that looks like that. We'll see a close-up of this area. The next slide is the city of Perth. And you really get a feel for what's going on here. They've built a city along here. Begun into the agriculture on this slightly higher ground back behind the coastal plain where the city's been built. And you can see that there's probably some good places for agriculture and some areas that maybe aren't quite so good. Some pictures have revealed ancient sand dunes running through here, and I suspect that in some areas the land is rather sandy and not good for growing things, but nice close-up picture of the city of Perth. So we go down around the corner. This is the Null Arbor Plain. Does not look very good for growing trees, probably why it was called Null Arbor. And it, again, is very distinctive with that red color that you don't see in too many other places. Going a little further, this is looking down your southern coast. I believe Adelaide is here, is it? Melbourne is under the clouds over here. But to see, just wait. Some of the rivers as they come down and empty into the coastal plains. I suspect that those don't have an awful lot of water in them right now, but certainly a nice view of your southern coast. And there it is. Here's Melbourne. Port Phillip Bay. It's been recommended to me that I try the beaches down here. I was at a ranch up here over the weekend. It was nice to see. I've brought a blow-up of this picture for the girls, and they can get out their magnifying lenses and see if they can find their house up here. A rather hazy picture, not the best picture in the world, but it does show where you're from, and shows that, again, probably geography was destiny, a nice bay that explorers could come into and tie up their ships and have calm from the ocean. Going up to the northwest part of the country, the Great Sandy Desert, this is the Hubble Space Telescope. So that was the main purpose of this mission. It's out in the bay, I believe, on this mission being repaired. But as they were doing, getting ready for the repair, someone looked out and saw this nice picture in the background. This is a very interesting area. Close up, this is the Great Sandy Desert, I think. These these are the Percival lakes, I think. They're very interesting. You can, again, we've caught them with the sun glinting off them, so we can see exactly where the water is. Sometimes when you look directly downward, as we did on, say, Melbourne, you don't distinguish the water from the land. But if you can catch the sun glint, you can see what's going on. And I think it's easy to see when you have a perspective like this that what's gone on here is that this is an old riverbed, an ancient riverbed that's been flowing down here. It's been invaded by the sand dunes and broken up into a series of little lakes. So the river itself is beginning to disappear. Perhaps when there are floods, everything joins up again, but at this point, being broken up into little lakes. This is a very interesting place. This is Cape York. And as I mentioned before, if you can find a place that's close to the equator, and you look eastward and don't see too many people, then you can launch rockets out of there. It's a museum of Australian businesses that are trying to get up a spaceport to launch rockets out of here. I think it's at about 12 degrees south of the equator, so it would be more efficient to launch out of there than Cape Canaveral, if you could get the things in there to launch. So it's a idea, and if this part of the world satellites or the manned vehicle, then that's probably a very good place to launch from. You might want to invest in some land up there if you get a chance. This is a very distinctive feature, the Great Barrier Reef. And as you know, it's not like the reef that you see in the Grand Bahamas. It's a living organism, the world's largest living organism formed by coral. And it's very unique. And the reason, there's some very definite reasons why it grows where it grows. Coral have to have sunlight, so it go in the deeper water that's out here because sunlight doesn't penetrate down. So it's growing on a continental shelf. It has to grow in clear enough water so that the sun can penetrate. So it's very important to keep this area clean, keep oil spills and sediments from coming in to block the sunlight. In eons past, when a lot of the Earth's water was tied up in glaciers in the ice ages, this area was not as deep, it was shallower, and so some of these areas died off and really got eroded away because the water was very shallow. Some of the deeper ones remained, and this is probably the extent that the farthest out they can grow because the water begins to get too deep out here. So there's a reason for it looking like that, a reason for it being located there, but it is the largest reef that we ever see, and when you wake up in the night and look out the window and see that, you know exactly where you are. I've been recommended to eat some of the bugs out of this bay. This is Brisbane and Moreton Sound, Moreton Island, and a very pretty picture of the city itself. Some nice beaches there, too. Looking down the coast, this is north up here and south down there. I believe this is Sydney Harbor, all right? Am I close, you think? There's a little lake right there, and I think that's Canberra around there. An interesting, very distant view, a wide-angle lens catching a large part of the coastline along there. Let's look a little bit further across the Pacific Ocean and go the rest of the way around the world. This is Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines and Subic Bay, where we used to have a large military presence, and Clark Air Force Base is, I believe, somewhere in here. This is a nice example of what's called a stratocone volcano. It ends up having very thick lava underneath, and it builds up and it builds up and it builds up until finally it just blows its whole stack, blows out one side of the mountain, creates a tremendous amount of ash. You can see that with every rainfall, more of this ash washes down these rivers. It's really ruined a lot of this section of the world. It certainly ruined Clark Air Force Base with a heavy layer of ash, and the question was, did the U.S. want to spend an awful lot of money refurbishing that Air Force Base, reclaiming it? And I think the people in the Philippines decided they didn't want the U.S. presence at that base any longer, and so here's a geological thing that happened that affected the politics of the region. So the U.S. no longer mans its Subic Bay base nor Clark Air Force Base there, but a very very big eruption there. We can see the ash. We could see the ash in the atmosphere for a couple of years afterwards. As you look through the atmosphere, you could see that ash at the lower levels of the atmosphere blocking the sun. This is a very interesting area, colder part of the world. This is the Kamchatka Peninsula that has a number of volcanoes that run along its spine. I think a lot of it is volcanic. This is a bigger view. I wanted to show you close-up views. This was a picture taken late in the day, and you can tell that the sun is down here somewhere, and it's casting shadows, and so you get a feeling of relief. This is not flat. You can tell that there's a lot of ripples in the earth here. You can look at a picture like this and see which of these is taller by the length of the shadow that it casts. This one is very interesting because obviously this one has erupted very recently, probably since the last snowfall, because this is the ash flow that's come out of there. So if you can catch a picture like this and bring it home, people can look at it and say, gosh, that thing is active. And a lot of times in remote areas like this, that's the only way you can find what's erupting, and perhaps send people out to study it, why it's blowing its stack and exactly what it's doing. More volcanoes. This is the Hawaiian island chain. And a very nice picture. You can see the series of islands. And what's happening there, of course, is that there's a hot spot beneath the Earth's crust, and it sends out volcanoes, and then it'll calm down for a while, and the Earth's crust moves on, and then it erupts again under a different part, and it's building a whole chain of islands out there. And these are probably the highest volcanoes in the world, if you can see the fact that they extend all the way down to the seafloor, the ocean floor. So even though they're not terribly impressive, when you're down here close to them, you know that you're only seeing the tip of the volcano. The Galapagos Islands. I think you can see that these are a very different variety of volcano. These are called shield volcanoes because if you turn them over, they sort of look like an old-time soldier's shield. And they have much less viscous lava. And so when the lava bubbles up, it does so rather slowly, and it spills over the crater in a distributed pattern, so that they're very even all the way around. They don't blow out the side. They simply bubble up over the top. And some of them are probably newer, some of them older, because in this case the crater has sunk down and filled in with the lake. This is a very distinctive island. This is a close-up view, but you can see that it looks like a seahorse. And you can see how remote and desolate it looks. So very strange place, the Galapagos Islands, but it makes nice pictures. Looking a little bit at South America, one of the distinctive things about this region is, of course, the rainforest. Much of the time it's covered with clouds. Much of the time you look down and it looks just like a big patch of green where you can see. But every once in a while you get a reasonably clear day and you get just the right angle on it to see all of these rivers and all of these tributaries, and you get a real idea about how much water is locked up in this area of the country and how massive their rainforests are and how remote a place this is. But of course what's going on with the rainforest is that a lot of people are clearing the rainforest, and what you're seeing here is the Amazon coming out of some of those areas that are being clear cut. Once they cut the forest off, there's nothing to hold the topsoil, and so it simply washes into the river. and washes downstream, washing most of the good soil with it. So it will take many, many years for the rainforest to regenerate itself. This is the city of Manaus. I think it's about 1,000 miles inland, but this river is so massive and so deep, they can bring ocean-going vessels up this river. This is the Rio Negro. I think you can see that it has a lot more living matter in it. It's a much different color than the river that's draining the areas that are being cut down. Most people don't think of the United States as having glaciers. We're in more of a temperate climate, but this is in the Alaskan Peninsula. We do have a state that's up north. This is a large glacier up there. You can see different layers of ice that have been set down. You get a real feel for how glaciers can cut great chasms in the earth because they are so massive, they are so solid, they are so slow moving. They can really cut deep grooves in the earth as they come down and empty into the sea. Coming further down the coast, this is the Cascade Range in the northwest U.S. Here's Mount St. Helens that you may have heard of, another stratocone volcano that blew its stack and covered much of the northwest with an ash layer. Seattle got a lot of the ash from this. I think this is Mount Adams and Mount Rainier. I'm not sure which. But you can see again where all of this ash it kills all of the greenery around here, and then the ash washes down into these rivers, causes a lot of trouble with the rivers that are going by. One of those volcanoes that, again, has been much studied because it is so close to major universities. San Francisco Bay, to me, one of the prettiest areas in the United States, nicest cities to visit. Again, it must have been nice for the explorers coming up here to turn the corner and come into this very wide bay with a nice river that you could explore inland. But this land here looks a little different from this land here. The San Andreas Fault comes right up through here, makes a little bit of a turn, and is off the coast up this way. But that's why San Francisco gets shook up every once in a while. This is a different plate from all of this stuff over here. They're sliding past each other, causing earthquakes. So San Francisco is not located in a really good place when you consider the earthquake potential there. Looking down the coast of California, this is the Pacific again. This funny little bay here is San Diego, the Salton Sea, a lot of agriculture around there. This is an amazing picture because of the vista that's involved. This is the Baja Peninsula, the Gulf of California. Right up here is the Great Salt Lake. The Rocky Mountains are here. The little black spot there, the Black Hills of South Dakota. So you can see halfway across the United States when you look out the window. And if you get a good wide-angle view and can snap a picture of it, it's amazing. We often say that you can't see boundaries in space. But if you happen to know that this is the southernmost big city in California, you can almost see something different going right along here. And indeed, we'll get a close-up of this area, and you can see why maybe you could define that as a border. Do you see the difference in land use patterns? This is California, where they have large corporate farms. Very straight roads. The fields are large, well laid out. Someone has figured out the most efficient way to get some use out of this ground, growing crops there, irrigating. And the people in Mexico are not quite as well organized. This is a city right on the border. You can see the difference. Their fields aren't exactly square. They're not. The roads aren't as well organized. This is really kind of small farmers, subsistence farmers, growing a variety of things. And so sometimes you can see borders. We say that you can't, but sometimes because of the difference in the way we use the land, you get a feeling that there are borders visible. A nice view looking. This is the Pacific, looking back over your shoulder as you head across the United States. This is Lake Mead, a dammed up river. I'm trying to remember which one. You see something that looks kind of like a crack in the earth, a wrinkle here? This is the Grand Canyon. It's about a mile deep. It's formed by the Colorado River carving a canyon through this rather arid part of the country. This is the Great Central Basin of California, where they irrigate and grow lots of the fruits and vegetables that we have in the United States. This is the Los Angeles Basin. You can see that it's, you know, it's against the sea, and it has mountains up behind it. And of course, lots and lots of freeways and cars. So if they don't have much wind, this mountain range keeps air from circulating in there. It's one of the reasons why they have a terrible smog problem there. You'll see that this is a very flat area. This is a dry lake bed. That's the lake bed at Edwards Air Force Base where we sometimes land the shuttle. You can see it's nice and flat. One of the reasons that we chose the lake bed at first was that it's the runways are marked out on a very flat area. If you're not steering very well, if your aim isn't particularly good, it's nice, flat, compact earth. And so if you miss your landing spot by a few miles, it doesn't matter. This is the Rocky Mountains. This is looking west. These are the snow-capped Rockies. This is Pikes Peak. This is the city of Denver. For those of you who enjoy skiing, you can fly into Denver and drive up in the mountains and find Aspen and Vail and Steamboat Springs and all kinds of wonderful places to go skiing. This is the Great Lakes. We've come all the way across the United States. You see the Great Lakes. They are, again, very blue and distinctive. I think the city of Chicago is in here somewhere, but very pretty. And nothing else in the world looks like that. And of course, I'm sure the explorers of old enjoyed coming in from the Atlantic, looking in here, looking for a way to get across the United States. They never found a way to get, I guess they called it, we're looking for the Northwest Passage. Never found it, but I think found many different things to do with the Great Lakes in the way of commerce. A lot of cities have been built up along the Great Lakes. A little further east, this is the city of New York on a clear day, not a cloud in the sky. Very impressive, the Hudson River. Another reason that geology and geography were destiny, places to tie up your ship out of the waves, places to go to explore down the river, good places to build houses. That's Central Park, Manhattan Island. This is Long Island, the tip of Long Island. Very inhabited. They've got some beaches along there. Probably not as good as your beaches here, but way to get out to the ocean. There are two small islands right here. One of them has the Statue of Liberty on it, so sort of a gateway into the United States. Let's go south a bit. This is the city of New Orleans. This was taken with a different kind of film, infrared film, to cut through any cloud layer and highlight perhaps some of the vegetation and things like that. But it's a nice picture of a different kind of delta. You remember the Nile Delta? Looked a lot different from this. It was spread out pretty much along the land. But what's happening here is that the waters of the Gulf of Mexico don't have as many currents. They're quieter, so that the river can come down heading at a fairly high speed, get all the way out into here before it slows down enough or is disturbed enough to begin to drop all of this sediment as it comes down from all the farmland across much of America that's drained into this. This is called a bird's foot delta, and I think you can tell why. There are a number of old channels. Sometimes back ages and ages ago, the river took a different pattern. This is the pattern that it's taking these days, building up this area. But I suspect in the future it will be slightly different. But the city of New Orleans is inland from it. Another city on the Gulf Coast. I'm not sure that you can see. This is an island here, and there's a bay right here. This is Galveston Island, Galveston Bay, the city of Houston, Texas, where the Johnson Space Center is, where all of the astronauts live. We actually live halfway between Houston and Galveston. There's an inlet off Galveston Bay called Clear Lake. It's not clear and it's not a lake, but it somehow got that name. And the Johnson Space Center, I believe, is right in here. One of the criteria for building it here is you had to be near a place where you could fly into. There's an old Air Force base in here. You can see that barges could come up into here and bring large equipment. My house happens to be right on that little place. You probably read about the floods. You can see that this is all very, very flat, lots of rivers emptying into it, and when it rains, it gets very soggy there. One of the interesting historical things, Galveston Island was for many, many years, back at the turn of the century, a very important port. They began to charge higher and higher tariffs. All the business people at Houston hated to see all the money going to the people in Galveston, so they went and, like good Texans everywhere, had a big project to work on, put on their cowboy hats and their boots, all got together and dredged a ship channel all the way up 50 miles inland, so that there's a ship channel here. Now all the ships come into Houston. Galveston has sort of died down, and it's kind of an old village, not nearly the shipping port that it used to be, and Houston is a very important shipping center, as you can imagine. This is the tail of the shuttle, in case you didn't recognize it, looking out the back windows. Another interesting view, this is the east coast of the United States as it heads down towards Florida. This is the Gulf Coast down here. This is the southern reach of the Appalachian Mountains. The Carolinas are over here. You can see how all of the land back behind here is kind of buckled up, and the rivers flow in the low areas. Some very good rivers for exploring if you happen to be a frontiersman back in the early 1800s. And all of the land east of the Appalachians had been used up. You might take a trek across the mountains to find some good farmland back here, and that's just exactly what my family did in 1812. This is the state of Tennessee. They followed some rivers down to this area. This is Nashville, Tennessee. Drove about 30 miles south, helped found this little town here, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. You can tell why there are not an awful lot of pictures from space. A lot of the times it's cloudy, and it's certainly hard to see. So that's my hometown. It was a picture that I hoped to get on my mission, and I did. Not very impressive, but there it is. So we're back to the East Coast again. This is the Cape, Cape Canaveral, with the Kennedy Space Flight Center taking most of it. You can see that this is the runway that we hope to land on. And again, you can see it's a pretty flat area. But here's where we launched from. Two shuttle launch pads right there. You can see how efficient it would be if you could launch from there, come back around, spend your time in space, land right here, be rolled off the runway to this vehicle assembly building for refurbishment, rolled out to the pad again. We save a lot of time by doing that rather than landing on the West Coast, having to be carted back across the country. It's one of the reasons that that we have this area, so that we can launch and land at the same place. Sometimes the weather prevents us from doing that, but it's much more efficient to do it this way. One thing about this runway is, though, that it's surrounded on three sides by a moat, and so you have to be very precise in your landings. I think you can see that there's water on the side here, so if your aim isn't very good and you've missed this by just a few tens of feet, you're off in the moat. Interesting thing about this is this whole area is a bird preserve, so we have lots of soaring birds. We also have lots of alligators that like to live in the moats. So before every landing, we send a little truck out that looks like this one. Where's the pointer? There's a truck that you can see right under the nose of the space shuttle. It runs down the runway blaring its horn to shoo the alligators and the birds away. So even though we're very high-tech, we have to worry about some some low-tech problems that might get in our way. But we have a lot of fun looking at the Earth. It's a very different perspective than what you might see from satellites, what you might see from airplanes. A very useful tool, I think, in helping to map our Earth, learning about how it changes. And we enjoy getting a chance to do this.